It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
It's not my role to sort out kind of judgment calls, but I do see it as kind of my role to be as much of a peacekeeper as I can, mainly because I know the kids that I'm representing feel it when their parents are angry and they're tense with each other and there's lots of chaos and turmoil. I know the kids that I represent are feeling that and they're in the middle of that, and I feel like it's my job to, as much as I can, protect the interests of the child by soothing over what I can.
Private attorney Jill Pierce explains the role and responsibility of a court-appointed guardian ad litem for a child in a child custody or visitation case. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll find out about the billion-dollar bait and switch and how states are diverting funds from the national mortgage settlement. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 168, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. States have diverted $974 million from this year's national mortgage settlement to pay down budget deficits or fund programs unrelated to the foreclosure crisis, according to ProPublica analysis. That's nearly 40% of the $2.5 billion in penalties paid to the states. The settlement, between five of the country's biggest banks and the federal government, 49 states, and the District of Columbia, resolved allegations that the banks deceived homeowners and broke laws when pursuing foreclosure. The settlement urged states to use the penalties on programs related to the crisis, but didn't require them to. ProPublica contacted every state taking part in the agreement to determine how they'll be spending the funds. Even states slammed by the foreclosure crisis are diverting much or all of their money to the general fund, including California, Arizona, Georgia, South Carolina, Wisconsin, and Maine. Overall, only about $527 million has been earmarked for new homeowner-focused programs, but that number should go up. A number of large states, New York, Nevada, Illinois, and Florida, have indicated they'll be dedicating substantial amounts of the funds to consumer programs, but haven't yet produced final figures. The banks will pay only $5 billion in actual cash penalties under the agreement. The largest chunk, $2.5 billion, goes to the state's attorneys general, while about $1 billion goes to the federal government, and $1.5 billion will be sent to borrowers who lost their homes to foreclosure during the crisis in the form of $2,000 payments. But when announcing the deal, state and federal officials said the state's $2.5 billion would mainly fund housing counselors and legal aid organizations. Studies have shown homeowners stand a better chance of avoiding foreclosure if they get the help of a counselor, and homeowners lack legal representation in the overwhelming majority of foreclosure cases. The money was divvied up among the states according to a formula that took into account how large the states were and how hard they were hit by the crisis. However, Virginia put the entirety of its $66.5 million into the state's general fund, then transferred $59 million into Rural Virginia Sewage Plant Improvements. This was despite a proposed budget amendment that would funnel that money to foreclosure prevention and home ownership programs. No wonder people's trust of government is at historic lows. For more information, go to www.propublica.com. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Craig versus Chater. In 1992, Rhonda Craig applied for Social Security disability benefits due to degenerative arthritis. Her claim was denied by Social Security because even though she had severe impairments of the musculoskeletal system, Social Security found that her subjective allegations of pain were not credible. The United States District Court affirmed, but the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed and sent the case back for additional proceedings. The appeals court noted that once an impairment which could reasonably be expected to produce pain is shown by objective evidence, allegations as to the severity and persistence of pain may not be dismissed merely because objective evidence of the pain itself, such as inflamed tissues or spasming muscles, are not present to corroborate the existence of pain. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Craig versus Chater is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law offices of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Richmond, and we are speaking with Jill Pierce. She is a private attorney in Chesterfield County. She was with various legal aid programs in Virginia for more than 20 years, and we're going to be talking today with Jill about her new role as a guardian ad litem for children. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you, Marty.
Will you tell our listening audience, Jill, what exactly is a guardian ad litem for a child?
A guardian ad litem is literally translated as a guardian for the suit. It's an attorney appointed to represent the child in that particular suit and to help the court in determining the circumstances around the case and basically being an independent third party to help the court understand what's going on.
And when does a guardian ad litem get appointed? In what type of a lawsuit and at what point during that lawsuit?
Well, I've been appointed mostly in custody and visitation cases, and I've been appointed when one party or the other has filed for an expedited hearing saying there's some emergency going on. Oftentimes, in most of my cases, those hearing requests were denied because the court is looking for an immediate threat to the physical or emotional well-being of the child. When they deny those requests, they'll appoint a guardian ad litem to come in and make sure that there's nothing going on. A court would probably expect a guardian ad litem to file another motion for an expedited hearing if the guardian ad litem finds something going on that a court needs to address immediately. Guardians would also be appointed in cases where abuse and neglect cases, child dependency cases, possibly foster care planning, those kinds of cases you'd find a guardian ad litem as well.
Well, what about the, I guess, typical nuts and bolts child custody, child visitation case where it's not an emergency, there's no allegations of abuse or neglect? Would the court appoint a guardian ad litem typically in that case, or were they not? And what would happen if one of the parties nevertheless asked for one to be appointed?
The parties can ask for a guardian ad litem to be appointed. I have not seen a lot of your just run-of-the-mill custody cases where a judge appoints a guardian. unless the judge saw that there was some situation that the judge needed to get a handle on and felt like the judge needed help in, you know, needed the independent third party. I don't believe in your run-of-the-mill custody cases. They're just appointed on a regular basis without some indication that an independent person is needed.
So people who have child custody, child visitation cases should not automatically assume that the court is going to appoint a guardian ad litem. There apparently has to be something a little different or out of the ordinary for the court to even grant the request or for the court to decide on its own to do that.
Yeah, I believe a court would probably grant the request if one of the parents made it. But just on a regular basis, no, a parent, you wouldn't expect just to appoint a guardian where there's no indication that one may be necessary.
Now, when a guardian ad litem is appointed, who pays for the services of the guardian ad litem, who, after all, is a licensed attorney?
There is a fund that the state pays a guardian ad litem out of for those people determined unable to pay. So indigent people can ask the court to determine they're indigent and let the state pay it. Otherwise, the cost of the guardian ad litem is assessed between the parties.
So is it assessed based on sort of the ratio of incomes? Like if one party makes twice as much as the other, they'd have to pay twice as much of the fee?
Not in my experience. In my experience, it's been split 50-50. I imagine a court may look at a timesheet and possibly assess more of the guardian's fee to one party or the other if it was apparent that one party used a lot more of the time, maybe unnecessarily.
And that's a good segue to what are the duties of a guardian ad litem. In general terms, what does a guardian ad litem for a child do?
In general, the guardian ad litem is required to make an independent evaluation of the circumstances of the case. So the guardian ad litem needs to meet with the child. The guardian ad litem needs to investigate the homes. If it's a custody case and the court has to determine where the child should live, the guardian ad litem needs to go in and see both homes, look at where the child might be living, interview people who might be in the child's life. Guardian ad litem probably needs to go look at school records, see if the child is attending school, what the grades are like. If there are medical issues, guardian ad litem should know what those medical issues are and which parent can best handle them. If there's educational issues, then a guardian ad litem needs to know what those issues are and get a feel for which parent is better able to handle those.
Now, when you're meeting face-to-face and interviewing the child, how does that work? Obviously, it has to be different depending upon whether a child is, you know, 5 or 10 or 15. But in general, what's that process like?
It's interesting. When the children are younger, say under 12 or 13, I have made sure I meet the child with a parent to begin with and try to establish that I'm a friendly face and that I'm there to represent the interests of the child to the court. And I let the child know that I'm going to come to school and pull a child out of class because I do want a conversation with the child that's outside of the presence or the influence of either parent. So I try to establish kind of a rapport with the child with the parent and then later go into the school within a week or two so they still remember me, get into the school and have a one-on-one with the child. Older children, you know, teenagers who understand my role and, you know, I don't think that I would be frightening to, I have gone directly to the high school and said, here's who I am and have been able to establish, you know, a conversation with the older children without meeting the parents first.
Now, I assume the one question you don't ask a child, whether they're 5 or 10 or 15, is which parent do you want to live with, mom or dad? But what do you do if a child, especially an older child, expresses directly to you a really strong preference? I mean, it is your role to look out for the best interests of that child, but not necessarily to advocate exactly what the child wants. How do you balance that?
I'm very careful up front to say that my job is to decide, based on my investigation, what I would recommend the court do, whether you live with mom or dad or somewhere else. And I let kids know that if they have a desire that's different than what I would recommend, that I'm obligated to let the court know that. And I have tried to talk to kids about, well, if you want to live with dad, I understand that, but, you know, is that because mom's too strict? If mom's too strict, is it, you know, you have to do your homework at 3 where dad lets you wait till 7:30 at night, you know? And I've tried to talk to kids about why, if your preference is different than what I see as probably in your best interests, why are we on a different page? Not that that will change my mind or the child's mind. And I let them know if I'm going to recommend something other than what and why.
And one of the other duties that are listed in the Supreme Court rules are to participate in pretrial conferences, mediation, negotiations. Do you find that you do that fairly frequently? And if so, what's your role? Are you the mediator, or do you just try to get the parties to meet with a mediator? What's that like?
It's very different if there are attorneys involved and if there are no attorneys involved. Some of the judges will order in the pretrial order that the parties, their attorneys, you know, everyone sit down and try to at least work out those issues that they can. That is helpful to some extent, I've found. At least we can narrow down sometimes, you know, which holidays we disagree on. I have found mediation to be very helpful. I always attend the mediation. And where it's just the parties, we've had great success in, you know, getting parties to kind of reach some middle ground where, you know, they walked in the room completely on opposite ends of what they would agree to do. So I love mediation. I think that's a great thing.
So you've met with the child, you've had these discussions, you've gone to both homes, you've gone to the school, you've spoken with both parents, you may have participated in a mediation, it may have resolved something, but not everything. Finally, you're in court. What's your role in court as a guardian ad litem for a child?
Well, my role in court is to make my recommendation to the judge. And a lot of times what happens is that if the parties are not represented, and sometimes if the parties are represented, the parties or their attorneys will tell the judge where we are. Sometimes, you know, we've reached an agreement on what we're going to call legal custody, but physical custody we haven't agreed on, or we've agreed on visitation, but not exactly what it looks like. And oftentimes a judge will get from the parties first what their position is, and then say to the guardian, where do you stand on this? And when the guardian makes his or her recommendation, then sometimes the judge will question, you know, why you came down that way. Some guardians will give a lot of history about how they came to that conclusion. Sometimes there may have been things filed that a guardian would have an opportunity to lay out kind of where they stand if they've had to file a CHINS petition or, you know, a motion to make some change while the custody case is pending.
Do you find that the judges follow your recommendation or really do make an independent decision regardless of what recommendation the guardian ad litem makes?
I've found that the judge gives a fair amount of weight to what the guardian says. And there are judges who will say, who will make a speech to parties saying, I'm making my own decision. I do have a guardian here who will make a recommendation. But there are some judges who are very careful to say, I'm going to listen to what the guardian says, but I am making my own decision.
Now, one of the things that guardians ad litem are supposed to do, again, according to the Supreme Court standards, are to maintain a professional working relationship insofar as possible with all parties without sacrificing independence. I would imagine that has to be one of the more challenging parts of being a guardian ad litem for a child.
It can get very difficult. I don't think I've had a case yet where someone didn't feel like I was favoring the other parent for some reason. And I think parents come in with expectations about what the guardian can do. And it's very difficult for them when I, as the guardian, can't say, well, you know, I understand you might disagree with the other parent's decision in this particular case, but if I don't see some serious emotional or physical danger to the child, and, you know, I think the child's welfare is protected, then there's not a whole lot I can do. I might be able to talk to the other parent and say, hey, that may not have been the best choice. But it gets very difficult when parents have different expectations of what the other should be doing, and then they want the guardian to sort that out. And oftentimes, unfortunately, they end up feeling like, you know, it's guardian is biased one way or the other.
And of course, it's really not your role to sort that out.
It's not my role to sort out kind of judgment calls, but I do see it as kind of my role to be as much of a peacekeeper as I can, mainly because I know the kids that I'm representing feel it. When their parents are angry and they're tense with each other and there's lots of chaos and turmoil, I know the kids that I represent are feeling that and they're in the middle of that, and I feel like it's my job to, as much as I can, protect the interests of the child by soothing over what I can.
What type of training does an attorney have to go through to become a guardian ad litem for a child?
A guardian ad litem needs to work two cases with someone who is already appointed or on the Supreme Court's guardian ad litem list, and take the CLE, that is representation of children, as a guardian ad litem. And that's all. As long as the guardian ad litem you work with certifies that you did in fact work those two cases, then you're on the list. I'd personally like to see a lot more training in that. You know, I did domestic relations work for 10, 12 years just with legal aid, and so I had some idea of domestic relations law and what I'm getting into, but I can see it being very difficult for someone to walk in as a guardian ad litem and start interviewing children or deal with parents who, you know, have sometimes unreasonable expectations. So I think it'd be great if there was some kind of mentoring program that new GALs would get a whole lot more hands-on kind of, here's how we do this.
Which is a good segue to the last question, which is, why did you decide to start becoming a guardian ad litem for children?
During my work with legal aid and the domestic relations work that I did, I unfortunately had a number of guardians that I didn't feel like they were doing everything. Maybe they hadn't met with the children face to face, or they hadn't investigated homes, or, you know, and I feel like these are some of the most important decisions that come out of our juvenile courts. You know, where is a child going to live? And I felt like it was just a very, really important job to do. And I was concerned that maybe there aren't enough people doing it really well. So when I left legal aid, I thought this would be a good way for me to do something I felt was important.
And we thank you for sharing your insight and experience. We have been speaking with Jill Pierce. She is a private attorney in Chesterfield County who is on the court-appointed list for guardian ad litem for children and was in legal aid for close to 20 years before that. Thank you so much for being on the show, Jill.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 58.1, which deals with taxation. Usually, only a maximum of 25% of your wages can be garnished, although this can be 50 to 65% if the garnishment is for child support. However, if it is for local taxes, it can be even higher. Under Code of Virginia Section 58.1-3952, the treasurer or other tax collector of any county, city, or town may issue a notice of tax lien and demand for payment to any employer, who then must withhold 100% of the employee's wages. No advance notice of the tax lien is required. although prior to the tax lien, the original tax bill and several delinquent notices almost always have been sent. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegebright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Who would have guessed that the rise of the internet and social media would lead to an explosion of illegal discrimination in housing? Join us next week when Rachel Dean, Fair Housing Director at Housing Opportunities Made Equal, reveals the shocking rise of discriminatory housing advertising. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright.